Welcome to Farming Aotearoa with Peter Burke. Kia ora and welcome once again to Farming Aotearoa, a program in which agricultural journalist Peter Burke brings us up to date with what's happening in our rural areas. Welcome, Peter.
Nice to be with you, Catherine. Yeah, it's good to talk about rural things because it's they get forgotten on the lamestream media. They tend not to do very much about it, but nice to talk about it. And today we've got a whole lot of topics to talk about, but the first one is really a bit of a serious one. I'm talking about Southland and Otago. And first of all, a big shout out to all those people in the rural communities, the farmers and the communities in Southland and Otago for what they're going through at the moment, which is not very pleasant. They've had some... Southland's had a very bad time. We'll talk about that in a minute. And Otago have also had the recent floods, which were certainly not very nice. So, yeah, it's sort of, you know, that time of the year when struck at a bad time, school holidays, all that sort of stuff. And suddenly, over the last few days, we've had these very major floods around in the eastern areas of Otago and down to Southland. So, interesting points here that in Otago... literally a month or so ago, they were in the middle of a drought.
Yes, crazy.
No declaration of an adverse event drought. Almost overnight, they're back in a situation now where they're in an adverse event, but it's with water, it's flooding.
Yeah.
And the flooding is very bad. And talking to a number of people, I talked to the Minister for Rural Communities, Mark Patterson. I've been also talking to MPI about what's happening. And certainly some of those communities have been very, very badly affected. And the full extent of that damage, if you like, and that disaster is not really known at this stage. The Rural Support Trust were telling me the other day they haven't had many calls yet, but they say that's not because there aren't many problems, but simply farmers are and those people in those rural areas are still assessing. They're getting on with the job of trying to get some sort of normality back into their lives, and then they'll start to assess what their needs are. So it's pretty bad, and I don't think... you know, we tend to think that it's a long way from maybe us and up here in the North Island, but down the south around the Catlins area, around Clutha, all those areas, they've been very, very badly hit. And it's we don't know what the stock losses are. There's been one comment made to me that because the farmers had plenty of warning about the storm coming, they were able to move their stock to higher ground, and therefore... There was a suggestion, but not a confirmation, that stock losses may not be as high as they might have been. Although I was talking to one person the other day, he was telling me that, yes, but there are some areas where it still might be quite bad.
Right.
And what you've got in those situations also at the moment is that it's happening at a time when lambing is sort of at the end of its of the season down in, say, Otago, Southland. But those lambs and that sort of those conditions, those wet conditions, will not survive easily. And the same with calving. So, if we're seeing stock losses, they may well be young stock. We don't know, but that's sort of where it could easily be. So, what MPI is doing at the moment, I was talking to their chief on-farm support person just a few moments ago, and he was telling me that they're busy going out to farmers. Reaching out to them, going around, door knocking, making sure where are you, what do you need, what's your situation like. So they're trying to get a build up a picture of where things are at. And that's Otago, which is, it's the floods, the instant floods that have caused the problem in Otago. The other thing that you'll find in that area probably is with the pastures being inundated, although the floodwaters have receded quite quickly. We've heard that the councils have cut some of the stock banks to allow the water to escape, so therefore it's getting back into the rivers. But a lot of that pasture will be damaged.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a lot of pasture there anyway. If you look at Otago, it's been drought. Therefore, feed was pretty scarce. There's no absolute word on this, but one suspects that there's going to be a feed problem, particularly in Otago, because of the situation. Lack of pastures, poor covers anyway because of the drought. This will not help matters. There'll probably need to be a reseeding of that. There's all those sort of things happening. We turn to Southland for a minute. It's quite a different story. They've had almost constant rain since April, May. You know, it has been dreadful, it's like it just doesn't stop there. It was a bit like that up in Te Rāwhiti after Cyclone Gabrielle, where again people were saying to me, why won't this rain stop? And I think the same can be said for Southland, except that it's very cold down there.
Mm.
And the same issues are arising where there is a feed challenge, probably, because, again, with those wet conditions, it doesn't make for good pasture growth. It doesn't make for good utilisation of pasture. And I think it's we're going to see the need for supplementary feed brought in, but there's not a lot available in those areas at the moment. So we are hearing that Federated Farmers and others are looking around to see where can they get supplement from, and then also looking at what sort of needs farmers might have. Is it, you know, in the case of Otago, with damaged fences, will they need fencing equipment, fence posts, wire, all that sort of thing? Will they need feed? What sort of feed do they want? Is it dairy farmers? Sheep and beef is a bit different. So we're going to see in the coming days quite a lot of work going on to see what the extent of the problem is. But Southland is, the weather forecasts are not looking too good. In Southland's case, there doesn't seem to be looking like any great reprise from that. It seems like it's going to continue, which is a real problem. So I don't know what's going to happen, but I think we're going to hear more and more about this. And the tragedy of it, as happens with all of these events, is that once they sort of go off the media's radar, then it sort of gets forgotten and you don't see what's happening.
But you don't think it's happening either.
You forget it's happening. So we've got that in Wairoa. I mean, I go back to one of my favourite towns in New Zealand, Wairoa, where things are still very bad. We're not hearing it on the media, but we know that things in that town are very difficult for people. And it's very easy for the media. We're there in and out a day, and once the flood's over, we're back and doing something different. But we have to remember that there are still towns around New Zealand where some are, after 2 years, are still not, haven't got access to their farms properly. And Southland and Otago will be in that similar position probably. So that's the assessment of that. The government have initially stepped in and put in some money to rural support trusts. That was a sort of a common sort of amount of money going in. But they're waiting on what advice will come from MPI, and then there will be probably another looking at seeing what they will do with that. Will there be more money needed? I know that Mark Patterson, the Minister for Rural Communities, he's actually a farmer down in that area himself in Otago. He farms in Lawrence. He embedded himself, he said, in the emergency management set up in Clutha. So he's been on the ground himself going around and just seeing what's happening. So government are lucky in a sense that they've got someone on the ground who knows about farming, who's a very good minister, to be fair, and is going to be reporting back to them what is required in that area. So there's a bit of positive sides there. And, you know, I think the assessment is that the good news was that they got good forecasting, they got a lot of the stock out. We're not seeing massive stock losses. We'll see the stock losses, but it might be patchy rather than widespread. So I think it's a wait and see for that area, and I don't know what's going to happen, other than just to say, watch this space, listen to the radio, watch television sometimes. Who knows what will happen.
Okay. What about maize?
Maize is an interesting story, and we're talking about maize grain. We're not talking about maize silage. So they're two separate things. Maize silage is sort of a wet, if you like, gathering of food, which is used commonly in the dairy industry as a main supplement. But maize grain is a more refined one, and when you grow maize grain, particularly in the North Island, it has to be dried to, I think it's 14 degrees percentage of moisture. The problem in the North Island, of course, is that maize is dried by the use of gas. And of course, gas supplies are there or thereabouts, or not thereabouts, anywhere at all. Unlike the South Island, by the way, where most of the farms have their own drying facilities, and they use diesel for drying purposes. They don't use gas. So what we've got is a situation now which is quite a problem for the dairy industry in particular. Maize grain is fed as a supplement, not a big one. What they do is it's got to be fed sparingly to animals, and mostly it's given out when the cows come in for milking. They'll get so much, how many kilos of grain as they're standing there being milked. But if you don't have that, then you've got to look. The dairy farmers will tell you that they've got to find something else, or the price will be up. The problem at the moment is that the maize grain sector had a very bad year last year. A lot of people lost a lot of money because the price collapsed, they didn't get paid, and normally maize grain is grown on contract. So the ultimate buyer of that supplier says, okay, we'll contract you to grow X number of hectares of this and you'll get this price for it. The problem they've got is that no one knows what the price will be because we don't know what the gas price will be. We don't know whether there's going to be gas there. And it's still up in the air. And there's a lot of work being done behind the scenes with Federated Farmers and other organisations trying to get some sense out of everyone. And there's no one's fault necessarily, but simply the energy crisis has really come and bit the farming community quite badly. And it's quite a serious issue. If you're looking at a supplement alternatively, you can't use, I mean, they use PKE, but there's a limit as to how much you can use palm kernel. The alternative is something like tapioca. That's another maize, essentially a carbohydrate. You can't use too much of it because it's not good for the animal. So it's got to be used carefully. And it's quite an issue. And I think we're running out of time because if it doesn't get planted soon, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
And there's a risk that we may have to import maize, which would be not the ideal situation. But that's being talked about. How that goes, I just don't know. So it's another one of these. We're into this sort of period of it depends. The word depends seems to be quite a popular one these days. It all depends on this. It depends on that.
It's tricky.
Yeah, but certainly it doesn't affect maize silage, which is different, and that's important to note. But about 50% of the grain that is grown is grown as maize grain. So it's a big component of the dairy industry, but not in the way that maize silage is. It's quite different.
Okay, all right. Talk to me then about the UAE trade deal.
Yeah, this is the ultimate fast tracking of a trade deal. Actually, the deal with the United Arab Emirates the trade negotiation has been done literally in the space of 4 months, which is quite amazing. But they're not calling it a free trade agreement; they're calling it a comprehensive economic partnership agreement, a CEPA. It's linguistic, and in effect, it's all but what we would have in an FTA. But I think one component has been left out of it to one side, but still there, and that was the issue of investment, and that was because the people in the UAE wanted that separate from the agreement. So what we are seeing now is this deal, which will benefit. We export around dairy, I think export something like $718 million worth of product to the UAE. We've got meat putting in 46 million, horticulture 44, and there's honey going in there as well. So there's lots of good things going. The honey people are very happy with it, obviously. I think it's while it's being called this comprehensive economic partnership agreement, it is an FTA and drag, if you like. In other words, it's the same thing, but there are subtleties, and I suppose you know. Diplomats and trade negotiators deal in subtlety, whereas bulldogs like me don't really care too much. We just call it the same thing, but we've got to go with the flow. It's probably going to form, what's interesting about it probably is that we're not going to see too many of these big comprehensive FTAs we've had, say with the UK and the EU and China. They're probably a thing of the past. We're going to see more of this sort of thing with the UAE. It will be something that might leave out a product here and there, but it'll still be the same thing. It's effectively getting a relationship there with some trade, and then the relationship is critical because once you have a relationship with a country, then you've got the power to begin to move more. And I think what people forget with some of these trade agreements, I know there was a lot of criticism about the one with the European Union, for example, where some people were saying, why didn't you press harder for this? Why didn't you walk away from it? Well, yes, you could have, but then you might have got nothing. So isn't it better to be in the tent and having something? And then maybe over time, working around that to say, can we review this in 2 or 3 years' time and then maybe get a better deal? The dairy issue is always going to be a problem for New Zealand. It's never going to be an easy one. It's going to be there. It has been there as long as I've been around in agricultural journalism, which is 40 or 50 years now. So don't expect any. There's no surprises on this one. But just be aware. It's the same. We're talking about India the same way, and there's a lot of emphasis on India at the moment, which is a great thing. But I think to get dairy as an export into India is going to be a bridge too far, probably.
Right.
But there still might be one of these deals struck, which would build that relationship and probably over time allow, there may be some other things around dairy they can do, but it may not be just selling, you know, truckloads of butter or cream or whatever it might be. India is certainly on the agenda, as is other countries in Southeast Asia. And that's the reason for that partly is because we've still found that China is still a difficult market. COVID is still having impacts in China, you know, 4 years out. The economy there is still, it's okay, but it's not, it isn't rising to where it was. And in that intervening period, the Chinese have negotiated other deals with other countries, so there's more competition in that market. So New Zealand is finding itself up against competition and having to deal with it. And I think what we're seeing now is a move to get other deals like the UAE one, and there'll be other ones in Southeast Asia as well. I see that Luxembourg's going up to Laos as well. There'll be other ones that will happen, which will just take a little bit of the heat out of that China market for New Zealand. And I think as we see the rising economies in some of these other Southeast Asian countries like Vietnam, Laos and others, that will open up opportunities for New Zealand to put its high-quality product there. We're seeing, at the end of the year, I know that the meat industry has got a very big promotion going in China to promote grass-fed meat, which will resonate with many people because it is seen as being natural as opposed to, say, feeding animals in industry-type situations, which is what is done commonly overseas. So hopefully putting this country of origin and also putting out the health attributes of grass-fed, which are great, there's no fat in it, there's less fat in it. If you do grain, you get fat in it. It does all those things. You can prove to people that this is a healthier product. Therefore, why not buy the healthiest product on the market? And that has some resonance, I think, with the discerning consumer, wherever they may be.
Yes. Okay. So, you've written a cryptic note for me: silver to gold.
Okay, silver to gold. That's my bit of a. This actually isn't quite what it means to be, but some great research work being done by Palmer or LandCorp, if you like, up. In a farm just out of Taupo. I was very fortunate to spend an afternoon there, really, with the manager. And what they're doing is they're looking at breeding a bull, a sire, for the dairy industry, which will produce a good dairy beef cow. So one of the issues in the dairy industry, as you know, is you get the cow in pregnant simply to get a calf out. The calf is a byproduct because they really want the milk. The calf is a bit of a nuisance, but increasingly because beef is in demand, they're looking at saying, now how can we breed a calf that meets the requirements of the dairy sector? The dairy farmer wants a calf that has a short gestation period, so in other words, it doesn't take long to come out, it's long, short, that it also comes out quickly, it's an easy calving one, and that in doing that, it will be a very saleable product. And what we're seeing with the work that LandCorp or Palmer are doing is focusing on this and building up some really fascinating genetics. And the farm at Gordy's is really interesting. It's a long, narrow farm, 18 kilometres long, just a narrow strip of land, almost in between two forests, two timberland forests there. It's quite big. The breeding is something that's quite special. They're breeding an animal called a silver stabilizer, that's what they're calling it. And the reason for me saying silver to gold is if this thing turns out to be really good, then it will be gold for the dairy industry. So we will end up getting an animal that is a bull that will produce calves that will suit the requirements of the dairy industry, but will also come back and produce a calf that the calf rearers will buy, that the finishers of those calves will buy, and that will sell well in the market. And it will probably, the aim is to try and get that animal ready within 18 months. And I know that from personal experience that if you grow keep an animal for 18 months rather than say 2.5 years, you actually make more money. And that's just, I can prove that a little bit there. So they're using different breeds there. They're using the Simmental, the Red Angus, and the thing called the Gelbert, which is a German breed, which is comes from Germany, is a thing for beef production, cross it with a Charolais, and you get this silver calf, and I've seen these beautiful silver calves here. They're quite gorgeous. You know, this black Angus-type mother cow, and then this silver calf coming out the other end. It's quite beautiful. So this is still a few years to go, but the hope is that they'll get the perfect calf, that the dairy farmers will be happy, everyone is happy. And from New Zealand's point of view, beef is still a meat that's in big demand all along. So there's a lot of good work being done there. And also there's work being done around the sheep side as well up in Gallifrey. And they've got a sheep operation there as well where they're looking at, again, to breed animals which are, you know, same sort of thing, easy lambing. Going back to the issue of sheep breeds, in the early 80s, New Zealand imported quite a number of different breeds from overseas with the hope of improving the fertility, the fecundity of the New Zealand flock, the shape of it, the conformation of it. One of the issues that did happen was that they brought in one, and I think it's, for memory, I'm not sure which breed it was, I won't get myself into trouble by saying it, but it produced triplets, which is, sounds lovely, but there was a problem with triplets.
Not for the mother.
The problem for mother, and it's also a problem for farmers too, because that ewe cannot really feed three lambs. So the thought now is to try and get that trait knocked out, if you like, out of the flock. Get back to say twins, which is fine, and then maybe even some singles, because I know through my own limited experience as a life sentence block farmer with my own lambs, that, you know, sometimes the singles grow better than the twins do, and that may be better. So there's a race on to get this sort of stuff done, which is again genetic based, and genetics I think is playing a very big part in the whole of the farming sector now. We're running out of I guess solutions other than genetics, and I think genetics will be, that played a big part. I mean, let's face it, New Zealand back in the 70s, New Zealand had 70 million ewes. We've got 30 odd million now, but we still produce roughly the same number of lambs. So, and I think that the sheep industry has proved above the dairy industry, quite frankly, in my view, that it's actually done a very good job. So that's something there. So yeah, interesting times in that side of it. So the trip to that farm was a experience of learning to see what can be done, and to see a silver calf, which is rather gorgeous, and maybe not a gold calf. That's different.
Okay, talk to me about this worm challenge.
Okay, Beef and Lamb have that's the organisation that represents farmers around the country, beef and sheep farmers, and they have a special person called Ginny Dudansky. She's a vet doctor. Who's been running a program in conjunction with other organisations, I think Dairy NZ is one of them, and others, to try and do something to deal with the parasite problem in animals. And worm-wise is a way of how can you deal with it. It costs New Zealand millions of dollars. And the problem is that when drenches, as we know them, were introduced back in the 60s, they were seen as a way of dealing with the parasite problem. So you drench the animals, and we didn't have all the problems that we have with them. But over the years, of course, the bugs themselves have got used to those, and there was a resistance to some of those drenches, and they've gone and gone and gone down the line. We're coming to the point now where, well, we're running out of options in a way, and so the answer is now to try and get to look at how can you deal with that, and genetics is one way of doing it. It's to try and deal with the problem through other means, other drenches, or better management of those drenches. The other thing we're seeing now is that in the case of climate change, we're seeing that as the climate's warm as we go down the country, the bugs are moving that weren't such a problem in, say, maybe the Central North Island, are now becoming a problem there because it's warming up.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing one particular parasite called Barber's Pole, which is it's a very bad one. It's a blood-sucking type parasite in the animal, in the gut. And that's moving further south. So what we're having to do now is to deal with this. It's happening in all the sectors at the moment, quite interestingly enough, that we're seeing that as the country warms up, everything is moving south. So we're getting this change of climate, and it's quite a big issue. Not only it's for dairy, it's for sheep and beef, and it's also for horticulture as well. So that's something that's also on the radar. And I think the Beef and Lamb have been going around the country, holding these seminars for people, showing them what the issues are. Jenny's been taking them through the steps they can take, and there's been a lot of interest in it. The one I went to one in Poirua, just locally, a good crowd of people there for that, which surprised me in a city. So yeah. So the other issue I want to talk about is the closure of the Smithfield freezing works down in Timaru. It's a very sad occasion for a lot of workers who've been employed there for a long, long time, and one has to really feel for those people that are going to lose their jobs. The reality of the situation is that because two things. One is the plant is an old one. It's 130, 140 years old. And yes, it's been upgraded a bit over the years, but it's probably come to the point where to further upgrade it is probably not worth it. And added to that problem is the fact that our passion for carbon farming in New Zealand has meant that land that would normally be used for livestock has now been planted in, I say, Christmas trees. I shouldn't say that, but I will. And therefore, livestock are not there. Therefore, there was less livestock coming through those works, and therefore, we are going to see this happening. Smithfield is the first. There's been others in the past. There may be others coming up. Who knows? But the issue really is that Smithfield is closed because of a whole lot of things, land use change being one of them, the age of the plant is another one, and I think the fact that we have a fewer sheep in the country is a real problem. So, interesting issue there for, and I think something to look out for in the future, potentially with others may find the same thing happening as well. The final thing I want to talk about today is bees. September has been Bee Awareness Month. I love that.
That's beautiful. Cute.
And I love bees. I think they're wonderful creatures.
They are.
So the Apiculture New Zealand has been running an awareness program around the country, and all these sort of bee hobbyists, people who've got a few hives, they've been doing a wonderful job getting out to communities, to schools, and making people aware of what the importance of bees in their communities. Bees are big in the big horticulture sectors like kiwi fruit and all those other trees, but they're also important in the home garden. You know, we have our vegetables are there because of our bees. I was surprised to hear some people saying they don't like bees, they're annoying in the garden. I thought, well, you know, it makes me think of the people in Crawley who complained about the tuis, but that's another issue. I've heard of that before.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Don't get me on about this stuff.
Oh,
anyway,
boy, well, let's not start on that because I'll be quite upset about that.
Yeah, but anyway. But that's the lovely thing. Interesting enough, the schools have been taking it up, and one of the nice things I heard was there's actually a school in central Wellington, they won't name it for good reason, but they've got their own hives in the back of their little school in central Wellington, and they have bees there. And I think that's wonderful that kids are seeing the value of these wonderful little creatures of God who don't live for long, but in their small lifetime, they fulfil a role that is very special to all of us. And I'm really in favour of bees. They're one of my pets, but I can't stroke them like a cat.
No, you can't.
I might get stung by it.
You may.
Yeah. So that's it.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming in again today. That was pretty comprehensive. And let's hope when you come in next time you've got some good news about Otago and South.
I absolutely hope we have some good news. And, you know, thanking very much of you guys down the South. We're really, you know, with you. And let's go back.
Thanks, Peter.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.